Night game tonight, Baltimore takes on Cleveland. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Monday, November 30th. Cloudy and breezy, light rain developing this afternoon, a high of 43. Here are the numbers. Wind from the east to 13. Overcast, 40 degrees for Racine, 39 in Kenosha, 34 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We begin today's morning show with an interview out of the archives that first aired back in 2007. We play this today in anticipation of the upcoming telecasts of How a Grinch Stole Christmas. Some of you may recall a really fun interview which happened here on the morning show a couple of years ago now with an author by the name of Charles D. Cohen, who is without a doubt the world's foremost authority on Ted Geisel, also known as Dr. Seuss. That book called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But the Seuss. We have Charles D. Cohen with us again on the morning show today, this time to talk about a special 50th anniversary edition of one of Dr. Seuss's greatest classics, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Charles D. Cohen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction, Greg. I had a great time speaking with you last time about that book. That occasion was the 100th anniversary of Ted's birth, and now we've got the 50th anniversary of one of his most famous creations, as you said.
And it is great to be revisiting this work in its original form, and then to enjoy this wonderful retrospective at the end of the book, in which we hear a lot about the background. I wonder if you would explain to our listeners one of the first things we see in that retrospective at the back of the book on pages 54 and 55. We see at the bottom of the page a strip of 8 different covers of this classic, How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about and what that says about this story.
Thank you very much again. Yes, what I found was, as I was doing research about this, was the surprising number of languages that this book has been translated into. It was translated into Icelandic, into Hungarian, Japanese, and down at the bottom of the area you're talking about are several of these different editions. And it's interesting, too, of course, he's not called the Grinch. I think in Japanese he's Gurunichi, and in Iceland it's it's Trolli, and in Hungary it's Gorcs. So he's become a well-known figure, not just where we know about him here, but all over the world.
As we learned from your previous book, so many of the creations that we've come to know and love by Dr. Seuss often had kind of long gestation periods in which he would maybe get the kernel of an idea and it would come to life in various forms and in kind of different stages before finally emerging. Tell us just how circuitous a route it was in this case from original idea to final flowering.
You put that so perfectly. I could have used you writing the book. That was wonderful. Yes, he had a phenomenal memory, Ted Geisel. and things would stick there. He would get an image or a thought, and he might work it out in one of his cartoons. He used to be a cartoonist and an advertising man. And then, I think, completely unaware, they would just sit there for maybe two decades and then blossom later. In this case, the first inkling I really saw of a Grinch character was back in the late 20s. He was combining several different things that children told their parents about. The parents told their children about. Things like the Sandman or the Boogeyman and the Santa Claus and the stork bringing children. And he said it was too much for kids to really remember, and that we should roll them all into one. And so he drew this image of a stork with antlers, and he's delivering a Santa Claus, which is also a combination of the Boogeyman, to someone's roof. And I think that Santa Claus Boogeyman image was probably the first idea of what a Grinch would be like. And you're talking almost exactly 30 years later when the book finally comes out. Now, in between, he continued to play with various ideas about the images that we have of Christmas, what would bring Santa, how would you change a reindeer, what else would you use. In the book, we used a couple of the Christmas cards that he made for family back in the 30s, and in one of them, there's a series of five of the typical Susian beast delivering Santa, and him saying, after all, reindeer are so common. He would play with these various images, and so I tried in the book to show that development, how the Grinch went from this boogeyman Santa into an advertisement for Holly Sugar, which is the first time you see a Grinch looking like the Grinch we know, taking Max and having him evolve from a dachshund with deer with antlers into the animal that we know with the antlers being tied on. And the same thing for the Who's, for example.
It's really interesting, too, to look at some of those early examples of a character called the Grinch. I mean, to see Dr. Seuss use the term Grinch not to describe the specific character that we know from this story. I mean, sometimes it'll be a relatively pleasant-looking character that will be called a Grinch for whatever reason. It takes us a moment to get over the shock of that.
Well, this is the fun of this part of my job. I get to find out of all these things. The first time that he used the word Grinch, it actually referred to a bird. There's a bald-headed Grinch that sits on a rock, and it's in the book Scrambled Egg Super from, I think it's 1953. The main character walks by, and that bird isn't laying eggs that day. So it was a completely different thing. And then he shows up a couple of years later in a story called The Hubbub and the Grinch. And this is another pleasure in doing a retrospective like this, is that people have probably never heard of The Hubbub and the Grinch, and we get to show people that story. But at that time, a Grinch was developing this sort of nasty streak. Basically, it was someone who sells people things that they don't need. In this case, a piece of green string that he convinces someone to buy, or rather a hubbub to buy. And then at the same year that he's having a Grinch sell people things they don't need, that's when he draws this Grinch character that we think of, and he's selling people sugar. He tended to do this where he didn't think so much about the interplay between the two, the commentary.
Of course, for a lot of people, they know this story best either from the most recent live-action feature film, or maybe even more likely from the magnificently rendered animated special from the mid-1960s. I suppose in either case, if that's how you primarily know this story, it's going to be a real revelation, in a sense, to pick up this book and read the story in its original form, although it really shows us how true the animated special was to this original work.
It's part of I find fascinating the evolution. When I went into this, I had forgotten that the Grinch had shown up pretty much every decade as a reimagined, slightly different-looking character. When you ask someone what color is the Grinch, they automatically say green. We all think of him as green. But when you look at the book, you realize that he was originally black and white with pink eyes and occasionally that red Santa suit. So the 1966 special that you're referring to that he did with Chuck Jones, in some ways almost supplanted this in the general consciousness that people have. But when you go back, this is still very endearing. There's something charming about this original. It was interesting. He was able to do such a fantastic job with Chuck Jones because they had worked together already in the Army on films. So they had a rapport. That one, Ted's main contribution was all of these lyrics for these wonderful songs sung by Thurl Ravenscroft. And But people may not be aware, just like they wouldn't know about the Hubbub and the Grinch, but the Grinch in 1977 appeared in a story for television called Halloween is Grinch Night, which won an Emmy. And then in 1982, there was a story called The Grinch Grinches the Cat in the Hat, which also won two Emmys. And Ted wrote both of the scripts for those. And then, of course, people know him from the 2000 movie with Jim Carrey. So this is part of what adds to his popularity. The original book people can read now. His messages are still timely, still relevant, but also people have seen it. New generations have seen it in ways that are comfortable for them.
I think in your retrospective, you really point out kind of an interesting point, which is that, here you are really doing a lot of research about Dr. Seuss, and in this case, really carefully tracing the emergence of this work and the way in which it's been transformed over the years. You point out quite rightly that there are people that have done PhD theses on How the Grinch Stole Christmas and other Dr. Seuss works, and you share with us something that Ted Geisel said at one point when confronted with that reality, that people were putting his works under such a careful sort of microscope.
Yeah, it's an odd position to be in. I always keep in mind that the quotation you're talking about where people asked him about that, and he would say how people would do this thesis about his particular use of a color, a single color. And, I've read these things, whether they be in theses or just in critiques, and people will go on and on about a particular color, and then he'll point out that it had nothing to do with that. It was that Random House was having a little tough time financially at the time and told him to cut down his number of colors. So I'm always aware of drawing conclusions. And it was a very risky thing to do, even if you listened to interviews that he did or read interviews, because he was such a great storyteller. All he cared about was amusing people, that he didn't always tell the truth. So, you have to, this is my job, is to go back to the first-hand sources, sort through the stories he told or the things that we've come to think about him, and get back to what really had happened.
It's interesting, too. You quote his memoirs where Ted Geisel said, "It's the product that's the most important, not the process of how it was created." It's so ironic that he said that because, in fact, your magnificent first book, The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But the Seuss, is almost entirely taken up with that process. And we're so glad you disregarded Ted Geisel's thoughts on that because, really, it only enhances our appreciation of the final product when we understand the process by which it was created.
Well, I appreciate that analysis and your incredible memory about the previous book. It's true. I think that both are true. I think what he was trying to get at was that in the end, as the artist, what he wants to see is the final product. He wants to see that this is something people can enjoy, that the artwork came out well. This was agonizing for him. We look at a book and we say, it's only got 200 lines in it. How long can that have taken to write this children's book? But he would agonize for a year and painstakingly to try to get down that rhythm we think of as Dr. Seuss, that particular lilt to the language, was just such an effort for him. That when that's all done, you want to know that that's what you want people to focus on. He didn't care about the process. But, that's fine when the book first comes out. But, you and I, I'm sure, and many of your listeners have enjoyed these books. Well, here we are 50 years. It's also interesting for those of us who want to go beyond that to find out, where do these things come from? For him, it's hard in an interview. He had a thing he would tell people, if there's this place called Zabilnikov, near the Swiss Alps, and he would go there every year to get his cuckoo clock fixed, and this is where he got his ideas for his books. He would just make things like that up because he didn't want to have to answer the questions. That was tedious. What he wanted to do was talk about the work. But for us now, it's fascinating, and I don't think he knew. I don't think he realized that the images that we see had occurred to him earlier. That wasn't of interest to him, but I think now if he could read them and go, geez, I completely forgot about that. And at the risk of running on in this, I had just spoken with his agent, Herb Chayette, who delivered at his memorial, at Ted Geisel's memorial, a wonderful story. I don't know if we have time for the whole story, but basically the point of the story was about Ted deciding that rather than being paid the most money per word, he would rather turn down the most money per word. And this story was about a piece that we included in this book. It was called The Prayer for a Child. But at the time, they didn't even know that had been published. This is his own agent, and Ted didn't remember writing that piece. It was a complete surprise to him when he saw that. The person who told the anecdote in 1991 at the memorial told me he didn't know that that was the piece until he read the previous book you were talking about in 2004. So, you know, Ted just, he did these things. He did such a massive amount of work that a lot of it would have been unfamiliar to him, and that's why it's worth doing these things and showing the process, as you had said.
Well, we're glad you did it, and we're so glad to have this 50th anniversary edition of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And Charles D. Cohen, a great pleasure to speak with you again. Happy holidays to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Mr. Grinch, you really are a heel. You're as cuddly as a cactus. You're as charming as an eel, Mr. Grinch. You're a bad banana with a greasy black peel.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas is going to be televised this week. Tomorrow night begins several different airings of the live-action film version with Jim Carrey. And on Tuesday evening, the 2nd of December, you have the opportunity on NBC to watch the classic Chuck Jones animated treatment of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Part 2 of our morning show coming up in just a moment.
You're a vile one, Mr. Grinch. You have termites in your smile. You have all the tender sweetness of a seasick crocodile, Mr. Grinch. Given the choice between the two of you, I'd take the seasick crocodile. You're a foul one, Mr. Grinch. You're a nasty, wasty skunk. Your heart is full of unwashed socks. Your soul is full of gunk, Mr. Grinch. The three words that best describe you are as follows, and I quote, stink, stank, stunk. You're a rotter, Mr. Grinch. You're the king of sinful sots. Your heart's a dead tomato splotched with moldy purple spots, Mr. Grinch. Your soul is an appalling dump heap, overflowing with the most disgraceful assortment of deplorable rubbish imaginable, mangled up in tangled up knots. You nauseate me, Mr. Grinch, with a nauseous super nos. You're a crooked, jerky jockey, and you drive a crooked hoss, Mr. Grinch. You're a three-decker sauerkraut and toadstool sandwich with arsenic sauce.
A moment from the classic screen treatment of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. It's 8:28. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to turn back to the archives and go back even a little bit further. The interview that you just heard dates from 2007, the year that marked the 50th anniversary of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. 3 years earlier than that was when I first talked with Charles D. Cohen, probably the world's leading authority on Dr. Seuss. And I want to replay for you a portion of that conversation where we talk about a previous book by Mr. Cohen. Here is that interview.
Well, fans of Dr. Seuss can rejoice in a marvelous new book which has just been released called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But The Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel by Charles D. Cohen, who is a dentist by trade and a collector of Seussiana by day and night, probably, one of the world's foremost collectors of Seussiana. And indeed, beyond the familiar children's books, which so many of us know and love and perhaps grew up on, there is a whole wealth of other material which represents the wide-ranging genius of Theodore Seuss Geisel. And we have Charles D. Cohen with us for a few minutes to talk about his devotion to Dr. Seuss and the experience of making this book happen. Charles D. Cohen, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's wonderful to speak with you.
Looking forward to it very much. Tell us, if you would, first of all, a little bit about your own devotion to the legacy of Dr. Seuss. When did that happen, and at what point did it end up kind of taking over your life?
Well asked. I really started back in around 1986. There was a touring exhibit that started out in San Diego called Dr. Seuss From Then to Now. And I saw that in about 1988 when it came through New York. And that was the first time that I learned that Dr. Seuss had done things other than the children's books with which we're all familiar. And I was fascinated, and I really wanted to learn more about that other side of him. But it turned out that there wasn't that much information out there. I had assumed that he's famous and so well-loved that people would have written about this. But there really was a dearth of information. So I'm a bit compulsive about these things. I started digging and trying to find firsthand sources. And as I did, I found that not only was there a lack of material, but that the material that existed often had misinformation. Not necessarily intentional, obviously, some of which was caused by him being a really good storyteller who often liked telling stories more than he liked telling the truth.
Right.
And somewhere in there, as I kept digging and digging, I started acquiring all of these things so that I could continue studying. And I looked around and said, well, wait a minute. I don't know how much of this stuff is being lost just to time. I mean, we're celebrating the Seuss Centennial, the 100 years. That makes a lot of his early work 75 years old already. And things are lost. Things fox and yellow and get brittle. The paper drives in World War II, things were recycled. One generation passes their collection on to the next who doesn't care about it as much. And I was wondering if things were just being lost. And as I cleared up things and found out what the real stories were, I felt like a responsibility to let people know, to let them know what the truth was, and then let them see these things that I'm finding, because they're so enjoyable.
Yes. Let's find out a little bit about what you call the digging process of uncovering old ads, old articles, all kinds of different examples of the genius of Dr. Seuss. Where did you dig? How did you dig? How did you know where to dig? I mean, because there's a whole wide world out there. You had to start somewhere, I suppose.
Absolutely. It's like a forensics experiment. You start with a little fact, and then you trace it from there. And there are numerous examples. One of the ones that I enjoyed was going through what would be considered a normal channel. I had found that he had done what I call lost stories in late 1940, early 1950s, which there are stories that people would know. Obviously, Horton hatches the egg, Horton hears a who, but they wouldn't know Horton and the Quugger bug, for example. And so I would get a lead like that a story exists. And then, thanks to the Internet, and this book could not have been written in 10 years ago, where you couldn't do all this research at this pace, you can track down and find out which libraries have it, make an interlibrary loan request. I found I waited literally a year to get one of the four parts of that particular story. I'm sorry, not of that story, but of a story in the Junior Catholic Messenger. And after a year, I said, well, wait a minute. We have the Internet. I have this ability. So 3 o'clock in the morning one time, I track which four libraries in the country carry that, write an email, track down the web address. Each place is a university, it must have a library, a library has to have a librarian, they have an email address. Went to bed after writing to four of them. When I woke up, three of the librarians had already emailed me that they had sent me copies of all four stories. I mean, it was a matter of 6 hours of sleeping or something, and you already have three different copies coming. So the process of tracking is aided greatly by what you can do with the Internet.
So you're lucky you weren't trying to write this book 20 years ago.
Literally could not have been done. And I appreciate that now. When I was saying that other books lacked whatever they were missing, I understand much better now.
Why that happened. It was not just carelessness.
No. It was just literally impossible to find these. And something like I always give my appreciation to a place like eBay because for a lot of people, this is just a way of tracking things to buy. And, yes, I do a lot of that. But for me, this is people all over the world doing research for me. If someone in Japan turns up an illustration he did in an arcane newspaper or magazine, that's great. Even if I don't own it, that goes in my database. Now I know that exists as well. And when you obtain some of these things, then you can start this forensics process. If I can, I'll give you one more example of that.
Yes.
He did illustrations for someone else's book The book was called Are You a Genius? Part 2. They did many others, but this was one in particular. So the first step in this process of research is finding out that he did that book at all. The next step is, if you're lucky, you find a copy. It's a somewhat rare book. But if you just get a copy of the book and it doesn't have the dust jacket on it, then all you know is he did these 6 or 12 illustrations. I don't remember off the top of my head. However, if you get a copy that has the dust jacket, then you'll find a little blurb that mentions that a game was made based on this, for which he also did illustrations. So until you follow through at least these two steps, you don't even know that existed. Then finding that is the next difficulty. But it's really just each piece of information, everything that comes in, I pour over every bit of it and then find out what else can I learn about him from the thing that I've just received.
I have to talk to you since we've been experiencing just how thorough this has been an experience for you. I have to have you talk a little bit about this wonderful process you undertook in trying to figure out the wonderful Dr. Seuss story of Horton hatches the egg. One of the things you do is you give us sort of the evolving answer which Dr. Seuss gave over the years about how he came up with this outrageous idea of an elephant sitting up in a tree, sitting on an egg, trying to hatch the thing. Answer changed. And then the detective work which you were able to do to sort of trace the emergence of this wonderful idea and story over the course of a number of years.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoy that. I got a kick out of doing that myself. And I think it's exactly what is needed to do really good research on this subject. I should add also, before I explain that anecdote, that I didn't mean to say that everything was done through the Internet. I also traveled to the Library of Congress, went to the Dartmouth where he went to college, went out to San Diego where the Mandeville Collection is kept, which has a lot of Susiana. So all over the place. But to get to this particular subject, it's a great story. People would ask him, of course, how he came up with his ideas, and one of the ones he told was about Howard and Hatch's the egg. And he varied it over 30, 35 years, which was the first thing that led me to believe that it probably wasn't exactly the truth. Again, he's a wonderful storyteller, and he enjoyed that more than he enjoyed the truth often. So the basic story was that he had a sketch of an elephant, a sketch of a tree, and what he told his biographers in 1995, who were friends of his for 30 years and enjoyed hearing his stories, Judith and Neil Morgan, that he told them that he left the window open, went out for a walk on the day after New Year's in 1940, and then when he came back, the wind had blown one sketch on top of the other, and he came back and saw the elephant in the tree, and bingo, he's got this great idea. But if you do the research and say, well, wait a minute, there are a lot of versions. Let me track down the facts of this story. Go to the New York Times and find out that actually the temperature that day was -5 degrees with the wind chill outside his apartment. It's not window up and go for a walk weather. And he had told that same anecdote several years earlier, and it was happening in the spring, summer area. So it's a lot of fun to go through first and find out, okay, that isn't true, so now what really did happen? And that particular story developed over a 10-year period, and we try to show through some of the 700 images that we have in this book the progression, the way he would work with different animals out of context, a whale up in a tree or different animals with eggs. You get to the point where at one point you have an elephant on an egg and it just smashes it. 2 years before the book actually came out, he did a story called Matilda, the Elephant with a Mother Complex, and it's the exact same story that we're familiar with of the elephant and the bird flying off and the elephant trying to hatch the egg, but has the exact opposite outcome. In the end, they think Matilda's an idiot for trying to hatch this egg. The bird flies off with no gratitude, the child, that is. So you can see that no matter what he told as the story, it's very clear that he was working and honing and changing this idea until he got to the great story we now remember.
It's good that you give us that fable, Matilda the Elephant with a Mother Complex, in its entirety. It's actually mostly text with really just two illustrations and then a moral at the very end of it. Moral, don't go around hatching other folks' eggs.
It's great to be speaking with someone, by the way, who has seen the book since it comes out today. It's wonderful that someone's been able to already read some and hopefully enjoy it.
Oh, it's a sheer delight. It really, really is. And it is really, in particular, so fun to see the evolution of certain ideas. When all we know is the finished form,
exactly.
The book which ended up in our hands as youngsters, to see the twists and turns that the story took as it evolved over time. You've done all of us a real service here.
Thank you. And what you were saying about the pleasure of being able to see the whole piece, I think that's important if you're really going to get an understanding. And, you know, the book itself, when you're dealing with a biography, tends to be geared above the average child's interest, although he, as an author, is of interest to children. So I wanted to have things that people could read to kids, like that story, or later in the book, the other one that we were able to publish in its entirety that people wouldn't be familiar with is called Speedy Boy. And we published portions of other really fun stories that people have forgotten about because they were never published again in books. There's a story called Tad and Todd about identical twins. Some of them are just marvelous, and I really felt this as we got into all the research and things for the book. It was this feeling of responsibility that came up to not let these things be lost to time.
We're speaking with Charles D. Cohen, and we're talking about his book called The Seuss, The Whole Seuss, and Nothing But The Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel. You, at some point in the book, take great pains to say that this is not a thorough biography of Theodore Geisel, and yet you do give us some helpful background information on who he was, his family, where he grew up, and in particular, I found interesting the influence which perhaps played on his young creative mind by a certain children's author whose books he apparently read, with the last name of Belloc, B-E-L-L-O-C. I didn't know this name. But when I read Dr. Seuss, I just think there's never been anybody like Dr. Seuss before, but indeed there sort of was.
Well, I wouldn't say that Belloc was a predecessor of that ilk. I think you'd find Charles Lutwidge Dodson, or Lewis Carroll, rather, would be more of the type of predecessor people would recognize. But he took things from different authors because he had this really peculiar memory. He couldn't forget certain things, particularly images. So with the Belloc books, it wasn't so much the text, which was more of a moralistic teach kids to behave sort of thing, but he remembered the images that Basil Blackwood, or BTB is the artist that did those, he remembered those images. I think you probably remember the images of the goat on atop the mountain. It was just a throwaway image. I have no idea why that stuck with him, but he reproduces that throughout his entire life, and there's probably 50 examples of it.
Hmm. Well, and I was thinking, too, you mentioned the fact that Belloc liked to often make up
yes.
names or words in order to finish out a rhyme.
Yes, absolutely.
And of course, that's also a familiar hallmark of a lot of Dr. Seuss's works.
Yes, clearly. He absorbed all of these things, as well as from other children's authors. Peter Newell, who did the whole book, for example, he got a certain playfulness out of them, and he did learn things like creating words, obviously. But I think you'd agree, he took it to a whole different level when he
right.
went
well,
to his own work.
Well, and you say that he sort of rebelled against the what you call kind of the puritanical tone of a lot of those of a lot of that children's literature. I mean, he might have taken visual images or certain styles of writing from it, but then it was towards the end of a wholly different and refreshing sort of moral or point to the story.
Yes, clearly. As a matter of fact, I've learned that in England and in Canada in particular, Dr. Seuss has sort of this anarchic persona. People really like this countercultural sort of feel that they get from him. And at first, I thought it might just have to do with a character like the Cat in the Hat, who isn't your traditional character, allows people to mess up a house rather than teaching them to keep it clean. But it was more than that. When you look at it, it fundamentally, he has this slightly anti-authoritarian influence where any character in power, whether it be a teacher or particularly any ruler, a king, whether it's the Kingdom of Did or whether it's Yertl, even as a non-human ruler, they're either idiots or they're incompetent, and it takes a kid to come along and show them the right way, show them how things should be done. I think that people appreciate that part of it as being a different take, a refreshing take, and a more normal take. I mean, the Dick and Jane series that people are used to reading back at that time, they're like sickly sweet kids. Nobody's like that.
Hmm.
So you get a whole different sort of version. And then, again, the types of things he's teaching them, once he gets their attention, to the idea of tolerance, that the person's a person no matter how small, that it doesn't matter if you have a star on your belly or not, that we should be tolerant and fight against prejudice. What more important things for the fate of the world, if you will, would you want to teach a child? And also the power and the wonder of the imagination. My favorite book growing up was On Beyond Zebra, and here he's telling you, you don't need to accept, this is again that sort of anti-authority thing, here someone's just giving you a simple thing like the alphabet, their whole intention is for you to learn it and then go on from there, learn how to read and write. But he's going, you don't have to accept even the alphabet at face value. What if there were things beyond Z or before A or between C and D or something? You know, you don't have to be limited. And it's not that you should flaunt, you know, your arrogance against authority. It's that you don't need to be limited, that you can use your brain, use your imagination, and create all kinds of worlds. Even a little walk to school, as in, I think I saw it on Mulberry Street, a simple walk to school, you can have a whole event, a whole parade, which you may or may not decide to share with other people, but you can amuse yourself just using your brain.
It's so good to see very early Ted Geisel, very early Dr. Seuss, if you will, dating back to his Central High School days, where you find all kinds of things, and where we see him not especially skilled as an illustrator yet, although trying, and I mean, I suppose creative in some respects, but a marvelously witty writer. I mean, a Mark Twain in the making in some respects.
Another of my favorites. Thank you. it's really instructive for me too to see that. It's kind of encouraging to see someone who doesn't draw particularly well, but we published one of his earlier pieces. I think it was his second published piece actually, which is a takeoff of My Captain, My Captain, Oh Captain, My Captain.
Yes, O Latin, O Latin.
Right,
very
exactly.
Good.
And you're sitting there going, this is a 14-year-old kid. First of all, they took Latin at that age back then. But that it's a very clever parody. And you can see that he's already a wordsmith. He loves playing with the sounds of words. And he quickly did develop quite a unique style as he started into cartooning. But to me, these are treasures. And I continue to find new things that date back to the early 20s. And each one to me is a little marvel.
He goes on to nurture along a career as a cartoonist, and for a time scores quite notable success in the world of advertising. Was that a surprise to you, just how much there was out there that he had done in this particular realm?
I gotta tell you, Greg, I learned yesterday about some ads I didn't even know about. I mean, I continue to. It's always a surprise, the extent of it. He did ads for beer and ball bearings, fans, furnaces, radios, rifles, sugar, scotch. I mean, an amazing array of things, some of which, beer and scotch, probably aren't people's image of Dr. Seuss. He did a tremendous amount of that, and they're great fun. I mean, it's the same kind of playful look, and some of these can get pretty large, some of the subway cards and displays for products that would be in a window. And they're great as collectible items, but they're a lot of fun, and I didn't want people to lose those.
Right.
And there's probably 1,000 or more cartoons, as you mentioned. That's how he started his career. He did this for 10 years before his first children's book. So there's a tremendous amount of that, and it's very varied in subject matter. Some of it controversial now. A lot of the beasts that we associate with him, this fantastic menagerie that he created, that everybody enjoys. I mean, that came from the Beasts of the Delirium Tremens. His family, as you mentioned, were in the brewing industry, and during Prohibition, basically they were out of that business, and he continued to poke fun at that, but people coming down from their alcohol high and seeing these delusional beasts, that's where those came from originally.
It's interesting not only for us to see his genius at work, but it's also sort of interesting to think about the whole realm of advertising and the idea of being willing to take a chance with something that would often be very offbeat, a very whimsical sort of way to talk about a product. I can imagine certain clients maybe not initially being particularly comfortable with some of the things which Theodore Geisel was coming up with.
Well, it took me a while to realize the genius of it, and he really was a very good salesman. I mean, we know this from a different point of view in that he manages to sell these ideas to kids in his books, but he was very good at this. And one thing I'm thinking of at the moment is he created a character called the Hanky Bird, which is a metal bird, maybe 6 inches high, and it would hang on a bottle of Hanky Bannister scotch. And when you think about why would he do this type of thing to advertise them, it's very hard to try to convince someone that your scotch is better for discernible reasons than someone else's, or that your motor oil is better than someone else's. And he didn't get involved in that. What he figured is, okay, you got someone sitting in the bar, they're looking across all the bottles, you're going to point to the one with the weird bird on it and say, hey, what's that?
You know?
And suddenly you've distinguished that particular product. And it worked wonders. I mean, his whole career as Dr. Seuss took off because he had these offbeat insects that he drew for Flit bug spray. And he never tried to explain why Flit was better than Flytox, which was the other bug spray at the time. Matter of fact, he didn't care. He was interested in getting an advertising contract with either of them. But what he did was distinguish Flit because people would see these chimerical beasts, these crazy insects, and that got him a following. So that's really how Dr. Seuss started. And even though you're not doing what maybe an advertiser originally thought, once they see the success of it, they're very pleased. And that brings other advertisers, other contracts.
An excerpt from a conversation dating all the way back to 2004 with Charles D. Cohen, perhaps the world's leading authority on all matters related to Theodore Geisel, otherwise known as Dr. Seuss. The book, The Seuss, The Whole Seuss and Nothing But the Seuss, a visual biography of Theodore Seuss Geisel. Again, we wanted to play these two Dr. Seuss-themed interviews because this week is your opportunity to view telecasts of not only of the live-action treatment of How the Grinch Stole Christmas, but also the classic Chuck Jones animated treatment of How the Grinch Stole Christmas, which will be airing Tuesday night.
He was grinchily humming. They're finding out now that no Christmas is coming. They're just waking up. I know just what they'll do. Their mouths will hang open a minute or two. Then the who's down in Whoville will all cry, boo-hoo. That's a noise, grinned the Grinch, that I simply must hear. He paused, and the Grinch put a hand to his ear. And he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started in low, then it started to grow. This sound wasn't sad. Why? This sound sounded glad. Every who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, was singing without any presence at all. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came just the same. And the Grinch, with his Grinch feet ice cold in the snow, stood puzzling and puzzling. How could it be so? It came without ribbons. It came without tags. It came without packages, boxes, or bags. He puzzled and puzzled till his puzzler was sore. Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before. Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more.
The time is 8:54. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. Tomorrow on the Morning Show, we look forward to Dr. Art Sear joining us from Carthage College, offering his analysis of events here and around the world. Later in the week, we will hear in its entirety an interview that we aired a portion of last week with Anna Boyardi from the famous Italian cooking family of Chef Boyardi. talking about her beautiful book called Delicious Memories. We'll also hear from Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. He'll be joining us on Thursday's morning show. Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. Taking us up to the top of the hour, here is a portion of Sergei Rachmaninoff's colorful cantata called The Bells. The Silver Sleigh Bells from Rachmaninoff's cantata called The Bells. And this was a recording conducted by Leonard Slatkin. Our weather forecast is for cloudy, breezy conditions today with some light rain developing this afternoon with a high of 43 degrees. Light rain is likely tonight with a low of 41. Cloudy and windy tomorrow with a 30% chance of rain, perhaps mixed with some snow. Tomorrow's high 40 degrees. Also on Wednesday, a slight chance of a mix of rain and snow. High of 38. Sunshine by the end of the week. This is WGTD HD.